Okay, this is the hour we will take your phone calls, questions with our two guests, Christopher Dunn and also Brian Forrester. So we'll do that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Brian, let me ask you first, of all these things that you've investigated, is there one area there that just fascinates you the most?
Yeah, I think the elongated skulls do, because I'm seeing correlations between them and the megalithic structures. Elongated skulls have been found in the Tiwanaku Pumapunku area around Cusco, Paracas. And what I'm finding is that the ancient road system, which connects all of these together, which most archaeologists believe were built by the Incas, are probably thousands of years old. So that's my major focus at the moment.
How about you, Christopher?
Well, I obviously, Pumapunku resonates with me, being an engineer, but also the mysteries in Peru are also fascinating to me, the construction methods and how they could have actually performed that work. All of that is fascinating to me.
And, you know, what I find just watching both your works over the years, what is fascinating to me is the fact that this planet worldwide has similar technologies all around. And like you said earlier, Christopher, they had to have some form of communication, or they were all located strategically in one spot, and then they went all over the globe. Something happened.
Something definitely happened. And, you know, the idea that what is very positive about not just the ancient alien researchers, but also any researcher into finding the truth about our past. And there are many different ideas, but there's a lot of cooperation between us. I mean, you know, there is disagreement, but there's a lot of cooperation. And that is what is most beautiful about this effort in this day and age. And the other thing is the number of young people who are actually resonating with these ideas now. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing, the number of young people who come up to me, contacted me. I was with some University of Illinois students last week, and one of them came up to me and said, "Hey, I saw you on television." I'm like, "Okay." He says, "Yeah, that was great. big fan."
Yeah.
And this is an engineering student, right? So, you know, the young people are actually picking up on it. And you know, as far as the conventional theories about, you know, dumb old cavemen or people crafting all these marvelous forms with stone axes and dolerite pounders or whatever, it just doesn't wash anymore.
So, why do you think, Christopher, the fascination with all this?
Well, I think it's because it's a big question mark. It's just, you know, I mean, people are driven to know the truth. And if they think that there's a part of history that, you know, if they've been told a lie or they've been misinformed, I wouldn't say a lie, because I'm not saying that anybody intentionally lies, but perhaps they're misinformed or they've been given incomplete information, then, you know, that gets their attention. They get very passionate about those things. I've known people who, you know, who watch Ancient Aliens, and they remark to me how they've learned so much from that, even, you know, if you take the alien agenda out of it, but the production values of the program and also the places that they have been to and shown the public that the general public just have not been aware of. I've seen places that blow me away on that show, and I just wasn't aware that they existed.
Me too. It is a widely watched television show, and I'm glad they're in their fourth year, and hopefully it'll be year five, too. You never know.
You just never know.
And Brian, how about you? What fascinates you about this, in that why do you think so many people are interested in this?
Well, I think it comes down to the essential question of who are we, where do we come from? And I agree with Chris. I wouldn't say that people have necessarily been lying about our past, but so many of these anomalies show up, such as the elongated skulls, the incredible precision that we know is ancient, and so I and others are trying to connect the dots, and that's why I'm so thankful to have a friendship and working relationship with Chris and with Lloyd Pye, with Stephen Mailer, with David Childress, with Graham Hancock, and others, because together we're putting the pieces together. You know, not one of us will do the whole thing, but I'm very thankful to have relationships with all of these great minds so that together, you know, we can help humanity hopefully remember who it is that we are and where we come from.
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Let's take some calls. We'll go to, who's our first person? David in Lynchburg, Virginia. Welcome to the show. Hi, David.
Thank you very much, George. I'm going to be really quick. I'm really excited about tonight's show. It's really awesome. And my question is to Christopher of his thoughts and his take on Edley Scallions, who built Coral Castle, what his thoughts are of how he possibly got a lot of the power plant theory right.
Okay, let you review that. Go ahead, Christopher.
Okay, in a nutshell, my thoughts on the matter have not changed since I wrote my book. I believe that what he was using was essentially related to what he wrote about, and he wrote about magnetism, and he wrote about electricity, and he had a different take than scientists on what the nature of magnetism and electricity was. So he believed that the Earth is streaming magnets, and that mm-hmm. magnets are related to the magnetic field or pull is related to gravity. And if you would be able to reverse the polarity of one object and align both poles, then objects would push away from the Earth rather than be attracted to them. That was his mindset. I believe that he was able to strike the right note frequencies using a vibration and electromagnetic radiation. So he had elements of radio equipment in his tool shed, his tool room at Coral Castle. He actually had copper cables strung around the place in a grid at one time. And so those are some of the observations, and that you can see the spools of the copper cables in his tool shop. So he was definitely doing something, and it hit on the right combination of frequencies or some technique that he used that was able to lift the block. Does that answer your question, David?
And he believed, Christopher, that every object could have magnetism. It didn't have to be just metal, correct?
Right. He believed that all matter was actually made up of individual magnets, and that, you know, just the atoms in the materials are individual magnets, and this magnetic field streams from the Earth, and that objects are actually attracted by it through magnetism, and that's essentially what we know as gravity. You know, one of the things that was an eye opener for me, and it's just a different way of looking at things. And you know, it technically may not be correct. Scientifically, it may not be correct. But using that mindset, using that theory, he was able to accomplish something that nobody else has been able to accomplish. Unfortunately, he took the secret to the grave with him. But I definitely believe that, you know, there is a technique, because, you know, my mind was shifted one time when I asked the question, when I started talking about anti-gravity. And a person who was with me at the time said, well, what is anti-gravity? Describe anti-gravity. And at that moment, I realized that anti-gravity is any technique that we devise or can use in order to defeat the pull of gravity. So if you're looking for anti-gravity devices, you can look at airplanes, you can look at forklift trucks, even the human body when he gets out of bed in the morning is employing anti-gravity. So it's just the technique that we use to overcome it. And Edley Skalnin, I believe, had developed a different technique.
Let's go to Julia in Utah. Welcome to the show. Hi, Julia.
I tried to talk to you for a long time. It's very hard. But anyway, I had this invitation that my boyfriend, he gave me a long time ago about you. And I listened for 4 years already.
Well,
I'm a student. I was taking a lot of archaeology classes in Utah. And I understood the conversation between those two archaeologists, you know, you have now, they're getting close to the relation between the Phoenicians, you know, culture. Mm-hmm. Because where my grandpa, he was telling me, because he was archaeology, he was telling me that 10,000 years ago, the Phoenicians, they come to Peru, and was who now that we know is the Incas. And the architect and all the influence that we had, it was close with the Egyptians through the Mesopotamia, because we putting all together the pieces and getting close with all the culture. And it's very hard to explain how the relation is, but if we look in the Quechua Aymara, it's a dialect coming from the Hebrews with the Chinese and Japanese.
All right. Well, let's get Brian's take on the Phoenicians coming over to that area of Peru. What do you think, Brian?
I think it's possible. What I really think is that because the Inca themselves, we don't exactly know where they came from. I think we're talking several thousand years of different people mixing and blending.
Right.
For example, with the Olmec people, you know, that's a very small part of Mexico. And David Childress and other people have theorized that because where the Olmecs lived was such a narrow area between the Atlantic and Pacific, that was an excellent little land bridge for people to not only cross from one ocean to the other, but also racially blend. So that's why you have the African heads showing up, you have Chinese-looking heads showing up. And living in Peru, you know, I see people who are native. Some look Hawaiian, some look Japanese. So I think we're talking about at least, you know, more than 10,000 years of people traveling around the planet, racially mixing. Quechua and Aymara are related languages, but their origins are very speculative. Some people say, you know, that there are aspects of, from India. Some people say Egypt. We just don't know. I think our history is so rich that it'll take a long time to get to the bottom of it.
Let's go to Mike, truck driving in Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program. Hi, Mike.
Hello, George, Chris. Good evening.
Hi.
I'd like to make a comment about lasers, and then I'd like to offer you a possible new construction on the pyramid.
Okay.
Chris, I believe you said we don't have any control over laser death.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
How do they control the lasers when they take that acrylic block and they take a picture and put it in there with lasers? They have to have some type of control over the depth.
I understand what you're saying. No, essentially, when you're inscribing inside a piece of Lexan, it is the focal point that raises the temperature of the plastic to a level that it melts. And so what you see is very minute bubbles on the inside of the block. But the light actually passes through it. Let me clarify that a little bit. Taken without the interference of any material, you cannot set the depth of a laser. You can set the focal length, but light is going to shine into the distance. Not like a conventional tool, which you can set the depth very precisely. And so it's the geometric forms that are precisely cut to a certain depth that cannot be done with lasers.
All right, Michael, you have a follow-up. Go ahead.
Yes. You're both familiar with the 3D printers? What if they use the laser, the hologram, whatever it is they want to design, and then they use stone powder and fill it with a 3D laser, with a 3D printer, I mean?
Well, again, I mean, yes, you can use the laser to etch and to affect changes in any kind of material. And so if you're looking at a laser to etch or to sinter material onto something else, then you can very precisely control it with modern equipment using folding mirrors, driving mirrors, marking lasers, just kind of etch the surface of a tombstone. But precisely setting a depth and machining out or cutting out something that is, I would say, between 6 and 12 inches deep with a laser, I would say that is an impossibility.
Christopher, if you were a witness to the pyramids being built, speculate for a moment on how you think they cut those blocks and then moved them.
Well, my speculation has been started in the Giza power plant, actually, in advanced machining in ancient Egypt, that the one of the better methods for actually removing material and controlling the removal of material and creating precise forms is ultrasonic machining. And so, that is something that we use in industry today, and it's used to machine shapes in very, very hard materials like carbides and ceramics and even granite. So that material, that method, when I look at some of the complex geometry in Egypt and in South America, it would seem to me that that technology would be almost necessary to create some of the artifacts that I've seen. And particularly when we look at the statues in Egypt, and you can actually see tool paths where a tool has cut along a particular path. They leave striations, they leave witness marks, and in some areas they actually drive the tool just a little deeper than the surrounding rock. And so those little signature marks indicate that a tool was being guided very precisely across the surface of the rock.
Gosh, I would have loved to have been there. We're going to be back in a moment with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. On our next program, G. Creighton Bradshaw joins me as we talk about ET intervention, the devil, angels. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come back in a moment, we will take your final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with our two guests, Brian Forrester, Christopher Dunn. We're going to have your final phone calls in just a moment. Christopher, in terms of new research into any of this, besides folks like you and David Hatcher-Childress and Brian, anybody else doing any cutting-edge research?
I think there's many people out there who are doing very valuable work, and there are too numerous to mention. If I miss one, I won't want to offend anybody. But I think the work of Stephen Mailer in Egypt is very valuable. Of course, there are many others. Robert Bavall, Graham Hancock have done great work. I'm very impressed with Brian Forrester and his work. He's actually done more to bring the civilization in South America to the public than anybody that I've known in the past. I mean, in terms of bringing it to the general public, I know that there's been valuable work done by past researchers, but Brian has worked tirelessly. He lives there. He's not just an accidental tourist. who goes there on a holiday and comes back and scratches his head over it. He's working on the ground all the time. And that's one of the main reasons that I elected to do a tour with Brian, because he has the heart of the Peruvian people, and he respects the oral tradition and the indigenous people. So that is very important to me. So, he's a maniac on Facebook, George. You ought to see some of his videos. They're incredible. Obviously there's more coming up. There are new researchers all the time. So I think it's a very rich and, very rich and vibrant field that we're in. Certainly we're not dying. We have been attacked very heavily by the opposition, obviously, over the years. Sure. But, the subject just doesn't die. And the attacks are more... don't offer anything valuable as far as explanation for our questions, so we just keep on asking the questions and gathering more data.
And Brian, what do you think of the Nazca lines, which of course the basis for Eric von Däniken's Chariot of the Gods?
Well, I'm very fortunate in that being in Paracas, which is right next to Nazca, I'm the assistant director of the Paracas History Museum, and my great teacher is Dr. Juan Navarro. And his theory, because he's the world expert on Paracas, is that the animal figures and the lines are completely different. What he believes, through complete logic, is that the Nazca made the lines because it's such an arid, dry part of the world, that what they were doing is mapping the underground water systems. So it really has nothing to do with aliens, and that the animal figures are actually at least 1,000 years older, and they were designed by and built by the Paracas people, who were predominant in the area. The Paracas took up a huge area of land, and they were absorbed into the more warfaring Nazca people who came later. So the elongated skull culture, who were the Paracas, in the archaeological record, they disappear about 2,000 years ago and are replaced by the Nazca. So it's a very complex field, but I think Senior Juan Navarro's logic makes a lot of sense.
All right, let's go back to the calls. We'll go to JW in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to the program. Hi, JW.
Oh, hi, George. Hey, thanks for having me on. I had to miss about 20, 30 minutes of the show, so I hope I'm not repeating anything. But I have to tell you about this guy in Michigan. He's an old retired construction worker. His name is Wally Wallington. I saw a video on him the other day, and he is moving stones by himself with nothing but wood. And these stones are 40 tons. He's making a Stonehenge. He's making a replica of Stonehenge. He stood on this video. I saw him stand a 40-ton stone straight up in the air and drop it into the hole using leverage and wood. And maybe that's why the tools down in South America, why they're not finding any tools, is maybe they're disintegrated like maybe they use wood like Wally is doing. And I just wanted to say that I think that the pyramids they were made by men. I don't believe they were made by anybody other than men, but just a lot of hard work. Because I ran the numbers and I researched. I did some research on this a couple months ago when we had another guest on it. And I ran the numbers on this. And it said that when they were building them pyramids, that they had only had to lay about 250 stones a day. And I think I looked up three different experts. The experts said that as many as 200,000 men worked on those pyramids, and I just don't think that's too much for 200,000 men to lay in one day. Because
I don't know how 200,000 men could get their hands and arms in the same area to pull these blocks and move these blocks. But you're right. I've seen the Wally videos, and he's moving them.
Yeah, but the 250 stones a day, I looked up the three experts. One expert said 20,000 men. One expert said 30,000 men. Another one said 200,000 men. But if you take the quarries were only 4 miles on the other side of the Nile, and the pyramid is only 1 mile on the opposite side of the pyramid than the quarries. So they really just had to move those stones 4 miles to a boat, ship them up the Nile, and then move them another mile to the pyramid. And on top of that, only 95% of the stone in the pyramids were just limestone, and they only weighed about 2 or 3 tons apiece. And the other 5% was the heavy granite, the 50-100-ton granite that had to be moved to 50 miles.
Well, but, so with the 250 blocks a day, though, and if they were working around the clock, they'd have to move 10 of those blocks an hour, those tonnage of blocks an hour. Let's get Christopher's take on this. What do you think of these, Christopher?
Well, I did enjoy Wally Wallington's video. I have seen it, and I found it very interesting. The granite, blocks in the above the King's Chamber weigh 70 tons. They were brought 500 miles from Aswan. So that's a significant challenge. I think everybody has a preference in terms of how they look at ancient cultures and what the evidence speaks to them. And I actually lean towards Lee Scanlon, who, if there were only 4,500 Ed Lee Scanlons, he would have built the pyramid in 20 years, the time that it took him to build Coral Castle. So that's a very small workforce using his technique. But Wally's done great work, definitely somebody to admire, and certainly somebody who is looking for the simplest method to do the simplest movements, then Wally's the guy, that's for sure.
Well, and under JW's thoughts, that you'd have to move a block every 6 minutes.
Well, it's not just that part of it, though. But you know, it's also some of the inaccessible areas where they were actually putting these blocks, such as there is a lintel block down in the passageway of the Khafre's pyramid, the second pyramid, and it was taken down the length of this passageway and then lift it up into position so that you have to pass under it when you go into the chamber down below. And so, there are a lot of construction problems involved in the pyramids that I personally don't think Wally's methods actually satisfy. So, but, you know, I'm not going to dismiss it. I mean, there's a lot there to be considered, and I think actually going to Egypt and going into some of those areas and seeing some of the difficulty involved in doing that work is a very important part of anybody's studies and research.
First time caller in Elko, Nevada. Hey, Chris, thank you.
You're welcome.
Go.
Time caller. I've got a unique perspective on things I wanted to share with you guys. I currently work with a truck that recently lost its title as the largest truck in the world. The new champion is only capable of hauling about 40 tons more. The reason that we use these trucks is because the key to efficiency, as we all know, is the most possible work with the fewest steps. I've thought about this for years and years since I was a little kid, and I've got an interesting theory that answers a lot of these questions that are unanswerable with the pyramids of Giza. If one stone were drug over there and chipped down in pyramid shape, and then squares were carved on it for aesthetic reasons, I mean, you can have 80 million people on it at the same time to relocate that stone. And I've always been curious if the great mystery of the pyramids is that it's 1, 3, or maybe even only 5 stones, as opposed to as many stones as we think it is. I think if you were to carve the shape of individual stones on one solid piece, It would explain why you can only go so far in there and no longer get between the stones, as well as with one piece, you can get as many people as you possibly wanted to relocate that one stone. And, yeah, I wanted to hear Christopher's thoughts on that.
Okay.
Yeah, that when you go to Egypt and you go to the Giza Plateau and walk around, it's very obvious that all the pyramids are made out of individual stones, and they're clearly defined. If you walk around the Khafre's pyramid, which is the second largest pyramid on the Giza Plateau, you'll find that some of those blocks have been stripped away, and they've been they used that place like a quarry in ancient times. You can see where the ancient Romans were slicing off pieces of granite, but they're definitely made out of individual elements, and it's estimated that in the Great Pyramid there's about 2.3 million blocks of stone.
Next up, we go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's Peter's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
How are you? Dr. Good, Bruce Peter. Goldberg is an expert in time travel. Why not ask him to go back in time and see how they did it?
Or remote viewing. Maybe we should do that, too. That could be, too. You never know. Next up, we'll go to Bill in Ormond Beach, Florida. Hello, Bill. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, I took care of a gentleman some years ago, and he said that he had been into the caves up in the mountains in Peru, and there was machines and equipment in there that was made of metals, not of this earth. And so he figured that the aliens had put them there. What's your take on that?
Well, the old extraterrestrial theory. Who wants it? Brian?
Yeah, I haven't heard anything about that. Again, what I'm trying to do is like what Stephen and Chris and others have found in the Cairo Museum, where you have these artifacts which seem to be precisionly made, like perfect bowl shapes with even fins on them. Egyptologists labeled them as being fruit plates or something, but clearly they were machine parts, and that's what I'm trying to explore in Peru, is trying to find artifacts like that that seem to be machine components so that people like Chris can theoretically reassemble them. But in terms of aliens and alien technology, the people in the Highlands see UFOs all the time, but in terms of actual finding of machines, I've heard nothing of that.
Chris, what about the Baghdad Battery? Any significance here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly has drawn a lot of attention because the ancients were supposedly they weren't considered to have known about electricity, let alone had a device. From my own perspective, though, it seems like it's a fairly primitive device, and when you compare it to the Great Pyramid is head and shoulders, both in size and functionality in terms of the electrical nature of it.
All right, we've got one or two more calls, and that'll be it. We go to Yuma, Arizona. Kelly, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
I have a question for Christopher.
Sure.
Since Dr. Hawass is no longer involved, is anyone going to be allowed to get into the chamber under the legs of the Sphinx?
That's a very good question, Kelly. I think it may actually become even more difficult. One of the things with Hawass was that he was very close to the Edgar Cayce Foundation. And so a lot of the explorations and digs and that were taking place were funded by the Edgar Cayce Foundation, and they had a close relationship with Hawass. Now with the Islamic Brotherhood gaining in prominence, the move is to actually be less open and progressive in terms of exploration, particularly if that exploration is going to reveal something that would alter the Egyptian history. So it's very delicate right now, and it's hard to say whether Hawass being removed is actually going to help the situation or not, in my opinion.
Brian, would you give us your website, please?
Yes, it's www.hiddenincatours.com.
Very good. And Christopher, which one do I still keep using? The GizaPower.com. GizaPower.com. Is that the one?
That is the one. www.gizapower.com.
Keep in touch with us, both of you, and let us know of any new discoveries. Christopher Dunn, Brian Forrester, thank you so much, both of you. Their websites, of course, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, and also their works, great books. One of Brian's, The Enigma of Cranial Deformation. It's about those elongated skulls. Christopher's, of course, The Giza Power Plant and Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. You've got both of those. And on our next program, we're going to talk a little bit about the devil. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.